morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Friday, September 29th, 2006. I'm Becca Bartleson.
And I'm Chris Andre. Coming up on this morning's newscast, a U.S. district judge says the Pacific Northwest cannot afford another failed salmon recovery plan.
U.S. war costs exceed $500 billion since September 11th.
And Belgian police arrest about 30 people after riots in Brussels.
Today's Portland area weather, mostly sunny, highs 80 to 85. Tonight, clear, lows 45 to 50. Republican Ron Saxton has polled within a few points of Democratic Governor Ted Kulongoski, according to a recent poll. The statewide survey of likely voters shows Kulongoski leading Saxton 43% to 38%, with 12% undecided. The remainder are divided among three minor party candidates, with Mary Starrett of the Constitutional Party getting the biggest chunk at 4%. Saxton has spent heavily for weeks on TV and radio ads attacking Kulongoski's support of taxes, while the governor has only recently gone on the air with advertising. Despite the attacks, voter support for Kulongoski has remained steady. The poll confirms that what many expected, the governor's race has turned into a fiercely competitive contest that could be decided by a relatively small number of swing voters still making up their minds. As such, the pace of the campaigns probably will speed up in the coming weeks, and Oregonians can expect to be bombarded by ads, mailers, and requests for cash. Republican kingmakers in Washington, D.C. have long fixed their attention on the gubernatorial race in Oregon. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
Armed Mexican drug gangs have made Southern Oregon's mountains their garden, cultivating tens of thousands of high-grade marijuana plants and, as harvest time approaches, setting the stage for potential violence. In recent growing seasons, the gangs have put undocumented migrants to work as gardeners in remote patches of Jackson, Josephine, and Douglas counties. The growth in Mexican drug gangs in Oregon helped to drive a 44% increase in identified drug trafficking organizations between 2004 and 2005. Oregon has been spared the kind of mafia organizations and rampant public corruption reported elsewhere in the nation. But the state is thick with homegrown gangs, including bikers, street thugs, and convicts, and criminal networks with tentacles in Asia and former republics of the Soviet Union. The Attorney General's report notes that criminal drug gangs cross many jurisdictions, forcing underfunded police agencies and a diminishing number of multi-agency task forces to be creative in finding and prosecuting leaders. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
In Eugene, just hours after Sheldon High School officials were warned about a threat of violence, a former student was found hiding on campus with two loaded handguns. The 15-year-old boy was held at the Serbu Juvenile Justice Center on charges of burglary, felony theft of a firearm, and unlawful possession of a firearm. The boy was arrested Wednesday afternoon after students reported seeing him on the school's athletic fields. Students had been warned that a former classmate might be armed and on his way. The boy attended Sheldon as a sophomore last school year. Eugene School District spokesman Kelly McIver said he's not enrolled at any district school this fall. The boy is also suspected of breaking into a house near Springfield on Tuesday and stealing several guns. This was the second violent threat against a Eugene public school in the past week. Last Thursday, police briefly locked down Willamette High School, a nearby Cascade Middle School, after learning that a former Willamette student threatened to bring a gun to the school and open fire.
A salmon recovery plan for the Upper Snake River has sharply divided conservation groups and lawmakers. Now the plan is headed back to federal agencies with a warning from a judge who says he will not tolerate any more delays. The ruling by U.S. District Judge James Redden in Portland formally sent the plan, called a biological opinion, back to NOAA Fisheries to account for the effects of a related plan for the Lower Snake and Columbia Rivers. Redden had already ruled last May. The Upper Snake plan needed to be rewritten to meet Endangered Species Act requirements that protect salmon and steelhead. Glenn Spain, Northwest Regional Director for the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, said the latest ruling, however, is, quote, definitely a shot across the bow of the federal government, unquote. Redden ruled previously that NOAA Fisheries and the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation must consider how salmon are affected by a dozen irrigation projects on the Upper Snake River, along with hydroelectric dams on the Lower Snake and Columbia Rivers. The agencies have been treating the irrigation projects and the dams as separate fish management problems, issuing two biological opinions, partly to guarantee enough irrigation water to Idaho farmers.
Rejected in Beaverton, Walmart has proposed a smaller store in another Portland suburb that turned down the retail giant. Walmart lost a bid to build a store in Gresham last year, but its land use lawyer Greg Hathaway said it has addressed concerns by reducing the size of the store and by promising to spend $2 million on traffic improvements. Opponents argue that shrinking the size of the store by 40% won't reduce traffic by 40%, and they say Walmart's proposal doesn't fit the zoning at the site it chose. The Gresham proposal is in the hands of a hearing officer. In August, the Beaverton City Council rejected a proposal to put a Walmart at an intersection just off a busy stretch of U.S. Highway 26, and the company said it would not appeal the decision.
Two defendants in a federal investigation of environmental activists faced sentencing in December on 8 counts of arson stemming from the $12 million fires at Vail, Colorado ski resort in 1998. Chelsea Gerlach and Stanislaus Meyerhoff were arraigned Wednesday of this week in federal court in Eugene. They are to enter pleas and be sentenced on December 14th, when they're also to be sentenced for other arson-related crimes to which they pleaded guilty in July. Under plea deals the pair made with federal prosecutors, both agreed to have the Colorado charges transferred to Oregon to be settled along with their other arson cases. Meyerhoff, who renounced ELF, ELF earlier, pleaded guilty to 54 charges related to 7 separate attacks in a plea deal for a recommendation from federal prosecutors that he be sentenced to 15 years and 8 months. Gerlach pleaded guilty to 18 charges in 5 separate attacks. She's apologized for the harm and fear created by her actions, which she said were motivated by, quote, a deep sense of despair and anger at the deteriorating state of the global environment, unquote. Prosecutors have recommended Gerlach get a 10-year sentence. Of the 13 defendants, 6 have pleaded guilty, 4 face trial, and 3 are fugitives.
The Umatilla Chemical Depot has turned its attention to destroying artillery shells containing GB nerve gas. In August, the facility finished destroying the last of more than 91,000 rockets containing the GB nerve gas and has spent 7 weeks getting ready to start on the artillery shells. The latest phase in the depot's program of chemical weapons destruction is expected to last until mid-2007 if there are no significant delays. The depot also holds VX nerve agent and mustard gas. The United States is under treaty obligations to destroy 7.4 million pounds of chemical agent in bombs, artillery shells, rockets, and other weapons at the depot by 2012.
Washington State. A mysterious midnight oil spill turned central Puget Sound beaches into a stinky mess. Afterwards, the Coast Guard proudly proclaimed that investigators had tracked down the spiller. The oil's chemical fingerprint clearly implicated a ConocoPhillips tanker. That was more than 1.5 years ago. But now, federal prosecutors in Seattle are declining to press criminal charges against ConocoPhillips, even though the chemical fingerprint showed that the substance spilled was crude oil, which is usually carried by tankers such as ConocoPhillips Polar Texas. The Polar Texas was in the vicinity of the spill in Dalco Passage on the night of October 2004. It was the only oil tanker there that night. The decision by U.S. Attorney John McKay's office not to prosecute ConocoPhillips doesn't mean the firm is totally off the hook, though. Federal and state environmental officials are still pushing civil cases against the Houston-based oil company, and a grand jury in Alaska investigated allegations of criminal conduct by the company in unrelated episodes, including the apparent cover-up of another oil spill. It's unclear whether criminal charges will be brought in that case. This from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer.
Former U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft does not have absolute immunity from a lawsuit over the material witness policies the Justice Department used after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. U.S. District Judge Edward Lodge refused to dismiss the lawsuit brought by former University of Idaho football player Abdullah Al-Kid against Ashcroft, current U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, the Department of Homeland Security, and others. If the trial moves forward, Ashcroft and the other defendants could be subjected to questioning by Al-Kid's attorneys, including representatives from the American Civil Liberties Unions, about their actions and policies in the months and years after the 9/11 attacks. Al-Kid, who played for the Vandals under the name Levani Kid, contends that in 2003 the government wrongfully arrested him as a material witness in its unsuccessful computer terrorism case against a fellow student, Sami Omar al-Hussein. Al-Kid and al-Hussein both worked on behalf of the Islamic Assembly of North America. Federal investigators allege that charitable organization funneled money to activities supporting terrorism and published material advocating suicide attacks on the United States. A jury acquitted al-Hussein of using his computer skills to foster terrorism and of three immigration violations after an 8-week federal trial. But al-Hussein, who was only months from finishing his doctorate study at the University of Idaho, was eventually deported to Saudi Arabia. Al-Kid, who never actually called to testify, but he spent 2 weeks in jail as a material witness and was later released to the custody of his wife with strict limitations on where he could travel. He sued, alleging that he was falsely imprisoned and that the government violated due process.
Republicans succeeded this week in pushing through a key piece of President Bush's anti-terror agenda, passing along party lines legislation that would endorse the military program to detain and interrogate suspected terrorists. The administration's allies fell short, however, in their efforts to authorize a terrorism surveillance program championed by Bush. That bill would have to be finished after lawmakers return for a lame duck session following the November elections. Both chambers this week approved legislation that sets up military commissions to prosecute terrorists. It also would prohibit the severe abuse of detainees like mutilation and rape, but grant the president leeway to decide which other interrogation techniques are permissible. The Senate's 64-34 vote yesterday followed a House vote of 253-168 on a nearly identical measure a day earlier. To avoid having to reconcile differences between the two bills, which were described as minor, the House planned to vote today on the Senate bill and send that version to the President to sign.
The House approved a bill that could grant legal status to President Bush's warrantless wiretapping program with new restrictions. Republicans called it a test before the election of whether Democrats want to fight or coddle terrorists. Majority Leader John Boehner said in a statement after the bill passed 232-191 on Thursday that the Democrats' irrational opposition to strong national security policies that help our national security should be of great concern to the American people, to always have reasons why you just can't vote yes, I think speaks volumes when it comes to which party is better, able, and more willing to take on the terrorists and defeat them. Democrats shot back that the war on terrorism shouldn't be fought at the expense of civil and human rights. The bill approved by the House, they argued, gives the president too much power and leaves the law vulnerable to being overturned by a court. Representative Chris Van Hollen said, "It is ceding the president's argument that Congress doesn't matter in this area."
In Britain, senior military officers have been pressing the government to withdraw British troops from Iraq and concentrate on what they now regard as a more worthwhile and winnable battleground in Afghanistan. The officers believe there is a limit to what British soldiers can achieve in southern Iraq and that it's time the Iraqis took responsibility for their own security. Pressure from military chiefs for an early and significant cut in the 7,500 British troops in Iraq is also motivated by extreme pressure being placed on soldiers and those responsible for training them. Military chiefs have been losing patience with the slow progress made in building a new Iraqi National Army and security services. Significantly, they now say the level of violence in the country will not be a factor determining when British troops should leave. The debate has been raging between different groups in the Ministry of Defence and has involved the Chiefs of Staff as well as the Permanent Joint Headquarters. Army chiefs have expressed concern about opinion polls showing the increasing unpopularity of the war and the impact on morale and recruitment. Political arguments, including strong U.S. pressure against British troop withdrawals, have won, at least for the moment. U.S. generals in Iraq privately made it clear they were deeply unhappy about British talk of troop reductions and complained that the British seemed interested only in the south of the country. This, according to The Guardian.
The Iraq war is currently costing U.S. taxpayers around $2 billion a week as the military places damaged equipment and tries to establish more permanent bases. A report by the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service projected that the war would cost $110 billion for the fiscal year 2007. This would be a 20% rise on last year and almost double the monetary cost of the first year of the war. The costs have increased despite a leveling off of U.S. troop numbers in Iraq and Afghanistan. According to the report, the extra money was being used in part because of a greater intensity of attacks on American forces. Another significant factor was the building of more extensive infrastructure to support troops and equipment in and around Iraq and Afghanistan. Although the U.S. military has said it does not want to maintain a long-term presence in either country, it is building semi-permanent bases to support troops, suggesting a recognition that deployments might be long ones. This from the Boston Globe, the Houston Chronicle, and the Guardian.
A trio of top Hewlett-Packard executives are at the center stage in a drama around the technology company's spying probe. Company chairman and CEO Mark Hurd ousted chairwoman Patricia Dunn, and Ann Baskins, whose resignation as general counsel was announced just hours before, appeared at a congressional hearing yesterday as lawmakers delved into the scandal. None wanted to assume blame for the investigation that was designed to trace a boardroom leak. It used a network of private detectives who impersonated the targeted individuals to obtain their phone records, snooped through their trash, and physically spied on them. And the two who testified before the House Energy and Commerce Committee indicated gaps in their recollections of events over the past 2 weeks. Dunn was grilled by lawmakers for hours, nearly all day. Hurd, the figure whom investors are most concerned about, did a far briefer turn at the witness table following Dunn, and with lawmakers admitting their fatigue, he is credited with turning around HP's performance in his 18 months as CEO.
Jack Abramoff had hundreds of contacts with White House officials, but they brought mixed results for the convicted lobbyist clients. This according to a congressional report. The draft report of the House Government Reform Committee said the documents, largely Abramoff's billing records and emails, listed 485 lobbying contacts with White House officials over 3 years, including 10 with top Bush aide Karl Rove. Abramoff and associates were successful in getting appropriations for some of their clients, but efforts to influence presidential appointments and nominations were often not successful. The report indicated that Abramoff and associates lobbied on behalf of 19 individuals for administration jobs and only was successful once. Another time, the lobbyist, who received lucrative payments from clients, was infuriated that some White House officials said they would work with the clients directly without the need for lobbyists.
European and U.S. officials have been holding last-minute negotiations to renew a deal on the transfer of airline passenger data. There have been warnings of chaos if an agreement is not reached by Saturday. Airlines would face massive fines if they flew to the U.S. without supplying the data, and they could be prosecuted under European data protection laws if they did. It is likely there would be huge queues at U.S. immigration as officials scrutinize the tickets of arriving passengers for some of the data they can now obtain electronically. Under a 2004 agreement between the EU and the U.S., U.S. Customs and Border Protection can access European airline reservation databases and pull out 34 pieces of information about each passenger. However, the 2004 agreement was annulled by the European Court of Justice in May, which ruled that officials had failed to give it an appropriate legal basis. Discussions between the U.S. and the EU appear to have gone beyond legal technicalities, which is why they are going down to the wire. Officials in Brussels say the EU wants to give away less data, while the EU wants more. This from the BBC.
Japan's new nationalist prime minister pledged Friday to make his country a divisive force on the international stage and push for a reduction of tensions with China and South Korea. In his first speech before parliament since winning the premiership in a landslide vote Tuesday, Shinzo Abe also vowed to move ahead with revising the pacifist constitution and exploring a collective defense system with the United States. Abe has struck a chord with the public by campaigning on a populist, nationalist agenda. He wants a more confident Japan that can distance itself from post-World War II guilt by amending the Constitution and giving the military a bigger international profile. He said, "I believe it's entirely possible to create a country brimming with attractiveness and vigor while maintaining the noble virtues of the Japanese people. I aim for a country that is trusted, revered, and loved by the world and asserts its leadership." Abe's Liberal Democratic Party has long campaigned to replace the pacifist constitution drafted by U.S. forces after World War II, to revise phrasing that renounces the country's right to offensive action and bans maintaining a military for warfare.
Thailand's coup leaders strengthened their grip on power today by sidelining key military supporters of the ousted prime minister. One official said a former army commander and close advisor to the king had been picked as interim premier. Thailand's Auditor General Jarovan Mainataka told reporters late yesterday that General Suryut Chulanont would lead the country until promised elections next year. Her comments were posted on the Government Public Relations Department's official website today. But the government has not made its official announcement yet, and when telephoned today, Jarovan denied her comments, telling the Associated Press, "I didn't say so." The new ruling military council has hinted that its choice is Suryut, and this morning Bangkok newspapers carried headlines that he would probably head the new government. His appointment was expected to be announced this weekend or Monday after it receives approval from King Bhumibol Ayutthaya.
The United States has imposed sanctions against Thailand in response to the military coup, which ousted its civilian prime minister Thaksin Shinawatra. The move involves cutting off $24 million in military assistance. The U.S. has urged the ruling generals to call elections as soon as possible. Last week's coup has been widely welcomed in Thailand, but it has been condemned by most Western governments as a step backwards. State Department spokesman Sean McCormick said the aid cut involved military education and training, peacekeeping operations, and counterterrorism. Funding for humanitarian purposes would, however, continue. Thailand is a key U.S. diplomatic and non-NATO ally and has played an important role in the U.S. war on terror following the September 11, 2001 attacks. This from the BBC.
Belgian police have arrested at least 30 people, including several youths, after two nights of rioting in a mainly immigrant suburb of Brussels. The trouble erupted in Les Marolles on Monday night after a young man of North African origin died in police custody. Faisal Chaban was found dead in his cell on Monday morning. He had been given sedatives by a doctor. Police said some of those arrested were carrying material to make petrol bombs. The situation is now said to be calm. Prosecutors said the results of toxicology tests would take weeks to come back from the laboratory. This from the BBC.
A leading Israeli human rights group says that Israeli forces have killed 3,733 Palestinians, including 767 minors, in the West Bank and Gaza, while Palestinians have killed 1,011 Israelis during 6 years of conflict. B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, said at least 1,812 of the Palestinians were not taking part in hostilities when they were killed, and 208 were object of a targeted killing, usually an airstrike aimed at suspected militants. On the other side, Palestinians have killed 697 Israeli civilians, including 119 minors, in the West Bank, Gaza, and inside Israel, B'Tselem said. In addition, Palestinians killed 314 members of the Israeli security forces. The group published the figures as it marks the sixth anniversary of the second Palestinian uprising, which began on September 28, 2000. In addition to the casualties in the West Bank and Gaza, B'Tselem said Israeli security forces killed 60 Palestinians inside Israel. Israeli civilians killed 41 Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza.
The leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq, Abu Hamza al-Muhajir, has called for kidnapping of Westerners. A recording on Islamist website says, quote, "I call on every holy fighter in Iraq to strive to capture some dogs of the Christians so that we can liberate our imprisoned sheikh," unquote. It's a reference to Egyptian cleric Omar Abdul Rahman, held in the U.S. over the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. It appears to have been issued to mark the beginning of the Islamic holy month of Ramadan, normally a time of prayer and fasting. The recording discloses for the first time the number of non-Iraqi insurgents said to have been killed fighting U.S.-led forces in Iraq since the overthrow of Saddam Hussein in 2003. It also calls for explosives experts and nuclear scientists to help launch non-conventional attacks on U.S. bases using biological or radiological weapons. The recording also offers an amnesty to those who had collaborated with U.S.-led forces or fled the country if they repented before the end of Ramadan. This from the BBC.
The jailed Kurdish rebel leader, Abdullah Öcalan, has called for his militant PKK group, fighting for independence from Turkey, to begin an unconditional ceasefire following a recent upsurge of violence. In a statement sent from the jail on Imrali Island, south of Istanbul, where he'd been held as the only prisoner since his 1999 conviction for treason, Öcalan said the ceasefire would help bring a democratic and peaceful solution to the conflict. The PKK, or Kurdistan Workers' Party, has made a series of ceasefire declarations in the past. More than 30,000 people have died since 1984 in its struggle for a separate state in the mainly Kurdish southeast of Turkey. Rebel violence has surged recently, and the United States has made promises of support in cracking down on the PKK, which is listed as a terrorist organization by both Washington and the European Union. According to the Kurdish Firat News Agency, while the ceasefire would be unconditional, Öcalan said the rebels would defend themselves if attacked by Turkish troops. This from The Guardian.
The head of Canada's National Police Force has publicly apologized to a man deported to Syria after being falsely accused of terrorism. Maher Arar was deported by U.S. Customs agents to Syria after Canadian police labeled him as an Islamic extremist. Royal Canadian Mounted Police Commissioner Giuliano Zaccardelli said his force had made major mistakes. Zaccardelli says he has no intention of resigning over the affair, despite calls for him to do so. His apology to Arar was unequivocal. This from the BBC.
Levels of the potent greenhouse gas methane are on the rise and could accelerate global warming. Scientists said yesterday that new research shows that the drought in recent years reduced methane emissions from natural sources and masked the impact of methane increases from human activities. The international research team published their findings on methane in today's edition of the journal Nature. Methane is the second most important greenhouse gas after carbon dioxide and is estimated to have been responsible for a fifth of the enhanced greenhouse effect over the past 200 years. Although methane is nowhere near as prevalent or long-lasting as carbon dioxide, it is far more powerful greenhouse gas with 20 times the heating-trapping effect. Methane is released by humans through burning of grasslands, forest, and wood fuel, as well as by intensive livestock activity, rice cultivation, and industrial sources. Natural decay of organic matter also produces methane. The study warns that increased melting of permafrost will boost methane, natural releases of methane. This from the Environmental News Service.
Touted as a celebration of sport, culture, and national unity, the ethnic minority games held in southwestern China descended into a farce of cross-dressing, cheating, and mob violence. Athletes representing China's 55 ethnic minorities assembled in southwestern Yunnan province last week to compete in blowpipe darts, horse riding events, and other traditional sports. But blind pursuit of victory led to some more unorthodox tactics. Results of the women's dragon boat racing event were contested after athletes complained of big women with Adam's apples. Referees subsequently found that several of the competitors were actually men wearing wigs. A dispute between a team from the game's host city and another team from Wenshan City over the result of a wrestling final turned into a brawl. The Wenshan team was eventually chased away by a local gang. A reporter at the games told Xinhua, "I've never seen violence and ugliness like that." This from Xinhua and the BBC. And that was the KBOO Morning News for Friday, September 29th, 2006. Thanks for listening. This morning's newscast was edited by Becca Bartelson with help from Chris Andre. Our editor was also Becca Bartelson, and the KBOO News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Becca Bartelson. Our engineer is also Kathleen Stevenson. This weekend's Portland area weather forecast is today mostly sunny, highs 80 to 85. Tonight, clear, lows 45 to 50. Saturday, partly cloudy in the morning, then mostly sunny, highs 70 to 75, lows around 50. Sunday, mostly cloudy in the morning, then partly sunny, Highs 65 to 70. Sunday night, mostly clear. Lows around 50.